Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Sarah LeDuc in for Ray Graff. We have two astronomers in studio today to answer your questions about that final frontier. One of the best-known and most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob Berman, is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. And Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Bob and Valerie, welcome back to Vox Pop. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The number to call with your questions and comments is 800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. And you can also email your questions and comments to voxpop@wamc.org. So the phone number, 800-348-2551. The email address, voxpop@wamc.org. What are we looking at in the sky lately? Bob and Valerie, what's up?
Oh, there's always something cool to look at. It's summertime, so it's like so much nicer up here in the Northeast to be outside. You know, you can check out the nebula inside of Lyra. There's not a lot of planets, though, unless you're an early riser. So that's something I'm kind of missing this summer a little bit.
Bob?
Yeah, they're bunching. The planets are bunched up in the hours before dawn. That's all going to change later on in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to move to a reasonable hour. But yeah, the Milky Way is really great. And if you don't have a telescope, mm-hmm. there's a case where binoculars are just fabulous. If you have a lounge chair and just slowly sweep the sky, your binoculars are better than anything Galileo had back in 1610, the first full year that he was looking at the sky and changing our whole mindset about the universe through his first handmade telescope. Your binoculars are better than that. So yeah, mm-hmm. just sweep the binoculars over the Milky Way, and you'll see little star clusters and patches of gas. And even if you don't know their names, it doesn't matter. It's just.
Who are you trying to convince, yourself?
Right.
Or
well, no, actually, I do try to convince myself, because when I go to the Southern Hemisphere to lead a tour, and I don't know the sky as well as I do the sky here. There's something about a million stars where you don't see the patterns, at least the first couple of minutes, and I don't know where I am, and I'm just looking up and seeing lots of stars, and then you get that sense of infinitude because you're not in your head. You know, you're not mm-hmm. in your logic. You're in the sense of awe that the ancients felt, and I miss that, and that's something most people can experience.
Yeah, we're still patiently waiting for T. Corona Borealis to explode. It was supposed to go probably like May or June were the initial predictions, but it's still up there shining very faintly, but literally any moment now, you know, we could go outside tonight and the star will have gone nova, so we're just anxiously awaiting for that moment to happen.
Incredible.
And since Valerie brought that up, let me spend 25 seconds and let everybody know how you can see it. If it does blow up, how can you find that new star if it becomes a new star? And here's how. Look overhead the first few hours after nightfall and look for the two brightest stars, because two are brighter than any others. One is bright and a little orange, and the other is bright and bluish white. The orange one is Arcturus. So draw a line in your mind from Arcturus to the other one, which is Vega. Go a third of the way from Arcturus toward Vega, and there'll be a bright but not super bright star. Now, that's the brightest star in Corona Borealis. The Arabs called it Alpheca. The Latins called it Gemma. Doesn't matter what its name is. That's the constellation that the new star is going to explode in. Now look closely at that star and you'll see that it's part of a kind of a circle that looks like the letter C on its mm-hmm. side. It's like a princess's...
Like a smile.
Yeah, like a princess's tiara. And that's the crown, the northern crown, Corona Borealis. Now count three faint stars along the crown to the left of that one brighter star, that's Gemma, that's brighter than the rest, three stars over, and just to the left of there, that's the spot that the new star will, we think, will suddenly appear in. So now you know exactly where. You look for the
now,
tuberculosis.
Now you know exactly.
Exactly where. Yes, yeah, you can really find that quickly if you just do this. Two brightest stars overhead.
I counted three fractions.
Yeah.
Might have to rewind and like draw pictures as he talks, right? It's so tricky on the radio.
Hold a template over it. Great. A new star.
Mm-hmm.
That's very exciting. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson are here for your astronomy questions. Valerie, you sent a few articles about other things going on in science and space.
There's always exciting things happening.
Of course. Tell me about the strong evidence for the first discovery of an intermediate mass black hole.
Yeah, so this is really fun. So, you know, I'm sure our listeners know about black holes, at least a very little bit. And we've seen small stellar mass black holes, and we've seen the supermassive black holes. And it's really weird that we haven't seen any in the middle. It would be like if you were an alien species and you came to Earth and you saw a bunch of infants and you saw a bunch of adults, but you never saw a teenager. And you were questioning, like, you know, how do you go from one to the other? Are they even related in some way? Is it an evolutionary process? What is it? So we've been looking for these intermediate mass, middle ground black holes that are like thousands of times the mass of the sun. And we think we finally found one inside of, I think it was Omega Centauri, this globular cluster that is above the Milky Way. And by looking at the motions, the way the stars move around, they seem to be orbiting something that's about 8,000 times the mass of the sun and not bright at all. So when we get that big and we don't see any glowing light along with it, it has to be a black hole. So that's what we think we've discovered, you know, within our own Milky Way, essentially. So if that's true, that's kind of our first strong bit of evidence for these middle-sized black holes.
Do you have any insight to add?
No, I just love listening to that because it's perfectly true. For some reason, if you don't mind if I jump to something else, somebody the other day was asking me about an idea. And of course, being with these national magazines, we get, as I'm sure Valerie also gets, questions all the time from people. And it brings up a topic that I don't think we've ever raised on the show. And it's the word falsifiable. Now, here's why that's important. This person was saying, now, when we see a black hole and we assume matter is going into it, we also see quasars, which are the brightest things in the universe that are actually in the centers of massive galaxies in the early universe. And there's huge amounts of energy coming out. Isn't it possible that material going into a black hole somehow tunnels through space-time, and when we see a quasar, that's where it's emerging? And when I was asked that, that brings up this topic, that it, believe it or not, it's not that hard to come up with wild ideas like that that sound really cool. But in the sciences, we use a thing, a concept called, is it falsifiable? And what that means is, can you also tell me a way that we can make an observation or do an experiment to tell whether it's true or false?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we can't, if there's no possible way to know whether your idea is true or false, it's just an idea. And people come up with wild, fabulous ideas all the time, but we in the sciences brush them off because they're really of no value unless they're falsifiable. So we also want to know not just the idea, but give us a suggestion of how we might test it or what observation we could make to tell if it's true or false. And if you could come up with that, then we're all ears.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 to call in to speak with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson about your astronomy questions, queries, comments. Catherine has written in to voxpop@wamc.org and says, sometime in the past few weeks, I heard about a meteor over New York City. If it is moving through the atmosphere, is it a meteor? If it lands on the earth or a house or the ground, is it a meteor or a meteorite? And what was the fate of the one over New York? Had you guys heard about this?
I haven't heard about the one directly over New York, but they happen all the time. It's not uncommon for people to see the shooting stars, the meteors and stuff. It's technically a meteor when it's close to Earth and going to enter, a meteoroid when it enters the atmosphere, and a meteorite when it hits the ground.
All right.
There's like a process. But, you know, we just use the term meteor in general to talk about this. And even if this one hit the ground, you know, it's unlikely that it actually struck the physical ground where you could actually go get it. Most of these little rocks, they'll just hit the ocean. In a place like New York City, man, would that be tricky to find if it happens to just be sitting on a sidewalk somewhere.
Very true. 1-800-348-2551. Todd writes in and asks, can you please explain how we even know this new star is going to happen? So the topic you guys were talking about a few minutes ago. How do we know?
Well, because there are something called a recurrent nova. There's six of them that we know of that are bright enough to see with just the naked eye. This one became bright in 1866 and then again in 1946. And notice that's an 80-year period. So 80 more years takes it to now. And those previous times before it became visible, normally it's a very dim star that requires a pretty good telescope to see. But to suddenly become naked eye visible and actually fairly bright in the sky, before it did it each time, it actually dimmed a little bit and then it suddenly got brighter. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what it's done this year.
Yeah.
Not only is 80 years up, so it's due in a way, but it dimmed a little bit. So we think all the prep is there. And our instruments like spectroscopes or spectrographs, which record the instrument that a spectroscope would see, shows us it's really two stars where material from one is settling on the other until enough has added up and then it ignites essentially and then you get this brightness. And it takes that long, an 80-year period. So that's how we expect it. That's how we know to expect it in that constellation of Corona Borealis. And I hope everyone was paying attention to how to find it, because there's going to be a test.
There's a recording. We'll post the show online as we always do, and people can nav to that spot to find the directions
there
again. I had a question. 3, 2, 1. What was my question? Oh, when you say it suddenly gets brighter, how suddenly? Like one night it is brighter?
Oh, yeah.
From our perception?
It'll be pretty much instantly. When these things go nova, you see a tremendous amount of energy. So it'll go from, you know, only visible with binoculars or a small telescope to naked eye visible in a night or so. And it'll stay that way for at least a few nights, if not a couple of weeks.
And it probably happened a long time ago in space, or no?
Well, that depends on its distance. Bob, do you know the distance off the top of your head? I don't remember.
I don't know the distance of T. Coroni Borealis. See, we have to use the Latin genitive form. So the constellation is Corona Borealis,
yes.
But when we talk about it, we have to say Coroni because it's the Latin genitive form. See how I'm avoiding the question? I've evaded the question.
You're giving me the 5 seconds to look it up. 3,000 light years away.
Okay.
So, you know, when we talk about something having already happened because it's 3,000 light years away, which means that this thing would have blown up 3,000 years ago, let's remind everyone that we always speak of events when the light arrives.
Okay.
Like we're all separated from each other here. And our listeners are separated from the person closest to you by 1 nanosecond of light travel time. That's a billionth of a second for every foot of distance you're away from them. So if you're walking down the street and someone across the street, 100 feet away, is saying, hi, Sarah. Well, they actually waved one. They're 100 feet away, so they waved 100 nanoseconds in the past. It already happened 100 billionths of a second ago. But we don't say, oh, they already waved. It's too late. I'm not gonna say hello to them because it's like old news.
Yeah.
No, we take the moment that we see the event to be the present. That's how we define the present.
Got it. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. This is Astronomy on Vox Pop with Bob Berman and Valerie Rabson. 1-800-348-2551. Give us a call with your questions or comments about space, and we will return after this break. Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Ray Graff. Today we are talking about astronomy, and we have our two regular and well-regarded astronomers in studio. Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson are here. The phone number is 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Another space news article you sent, Valerie, was about the red spot on Jupiter.
Yeah.
Bring us up to date on this.
Yeah, so something I've been teaching my students for ages is that, you know, the red spot has been there for like 400 years. We know that, you know, people around Galileo's time observed it, sketched it. Late 1600s, we have beautiful pictures of like this huge spot on the side of Jupiter. They had no idea what it was, but they saw that it was a different type of feature. And then it turns out that nobody really, it's not that they didn't draw Jupiter, it's that they didn't draw Jupiter with a spot for almost 100 years, from like 1715 to the 1820s or 30s. And there were a lot of famous astronomers around at that time that were doing a ton of observing. So it's not like nobody looked at Jupiter.
Okay.
But we didn't see the spot. So there's new thinking that maybe during this time frame, the spot actually disappeared. And then we have lots of sketches and then eventually photographs in the 1800s of the spot coming back, and it's now shrinking again, which is what has inspired people to really go look at this. But this could be like the second resurgence of this storm since we've been able to observe it with telescopes or binoculars. So I got to go back and change all of my slides for next semester when we talk about this, but it's kind of neat. And then thinking about what would have caused the storm to go away and how do you get it to come back? Right? I mean, we see storms form, tornadoes, hurricanes on Earth all the time, but the dynamics on a planet like Jupiter or Saturn are a little bit different. So scientists have been working through some models that show that you can actually spin up a gaseous atmosphere enough to generate a storm that will stay for a while. And maybe that's the case with Jupiter, is that, you know, this storm comes and goes every couple hundred years, and we're just in a lucky time where we've been able to see it for a while.
Got it. Do we know why it's red?
We were chatting about this before, right? Yeah, the answer is no, right?
Yeah, one of the most famous astro imagers is Carolyn Porco, who was the lead imager for both the Galileo and the Cassini spacecraft that went to Jupiter and in the latter case to Saturn as well. And I had when I was with Discover magazine for 17 years, one of the great things about being with that magazine is you could call up anybody, any astronomer, any astronaut, and ask them anything, and they would always come to the phone because they want to see their words in national magazines and be read by a million people, not just in the little journals that some of us read, but are only read by a few tens of thousands of people. Anyway, I got to ask Carolyn Porco, why is the red spot red? Because I really didn't know. And she didn't know either, which was the most amazing thing. She said, well, maybe it's phosphine. Maybe it's a phosphorus chemical, but it could be a compound of sulfur also. And there are reddish sulfur compounds. And so, you know, just in case you didn't have enough to worry about here on Earth, or you want to blame the darn Biden administration for something else, you could think of the red spot that we're more insecure about it than we were a little while ago.
But not knowing
why it's red
predates the current administration and the one before that, I assume, and the one before that, because we've never known. I certainly don't know, but science also doesn't know.
But there's hope, right? I mean, especially if we send more spacecrafts to Jupiter or our telescopes get bigger as they continue to do, I mean, we can do high-quality spectroscopy and hopefully be able to tease out these molecules that don't have really strong signatures, which is why it's hard to tell in the first place. And eventually we should be able to figure these kind of basic things out.
1-800-348-2551. To speak with Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson about astronomy, give us a call, 800-348-2551. Let's go to Rick in Albany. Hello, Rick.
Hello. I'm trying to see if it's this week in upstate New York, will Saturn and or Saturn's rings be more visible, more available to be seen?
Should I take that?
Go ahead.
Yeah. It's Saturn these days is more like a midnight object. It's in the constellation of Aquarius this year. And if you want to make out the stars of Aquarius, just look at the little dots around Saturn. Saturn's the only bright object in the southeast at around midnight. So if you look kind of lowish in the southeast, any bright star is that. And if you have a small telescope, of course, instantly you'll identify it because of the rings. But you've got to look fast because mm-hmm. the rings are almost perfectly edgewise. They'll be edgewise in March. Right now they're tilted so close to edgewise that they almost look like a white line instead of real rings. But still, you can make out rings if you rush. So look for Saturn with whatever telescope you've got. 60 power is plenty. You don't need much magnification, and it's there low in the southeast. Now, as for Aquarius, we look at constellations for what they are, not what they're supposed to be, because of the 88 constellations, very few resemble what they're supposed to look like. Scorpius really does look like a scorpion, but most of them don't. Mm-hmm. So instead, when we see Cassiopeia, who's supposed to be a queen seated in a chair, what it really looks like is a letter W or M, depending on the time of the year or the time of the night. But so if we make out the W, we'll say, oh, yeah, that's Cassiopeia. We don't try to make out a woman sitting on a chair. But with Aquarius, it's hopeless. It's just such random dots that you can't make out anything. No letter, no shape. It's just disparate dots that there's no more challenging constellation than that. So I'm bringing it up because once you see the bright star-like thing, which is Saturn, look at all the dots around it. And what I'm asking listeners to do is you try it and see if you can make a figure of a male carrying a big urn of water. I mean, you know, water weighs is heavy. It's 8 pounds a gallon. So no wonder he's all hunched over in the classical figures. But see what you can do with it.
Is that good, Rick? Do you have any follow-ups? Rick, hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi, do you have any follow-up questions about Saturn or anything?
No, that was good.
All right.
I got more or less what I needed. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you for calling. Have a great day. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Yes, Valerie?
I was just saying, I was laughing to myself as you were talking because Aquarius is one of the ones when I'm doing a planetarium show, I, you know, circle that region of sky and then put up the picture and say this is where Aquarius is. And I was curious how you were going to describe how to find it because I don't have a good solution. And I'm glad you don't have a good solution either.
No, it's the worst of all of them. And that's my zodiacal sign.
Me too.
If we believed in astrology. No astronomer believes in astrology. So
the new one or the old one? Like the version where, you know, the sun on the actual year you were born was in Aquarius, or like the historic 2,000-year-old version?
Do
you know?
Now, and the reason Valerie's saying that is that everything has shifted thanks to precession. Earth's axis wobbles every 25,800 years. And in that almost 26,000-year wobble, it shifts everything. So mm-hmm. that's why when we say the age of Aquarius or the first point of Aries, things aren't where they used to be. Mm-hmm. So you can use either the modern constellations, which is what they do in India, by the way. The astrologers in India use the actual constellations that are in that spot now. But the astrologers in Europe and America use the imaginary signs of blank parts of the sky that don't correspond to the star patterns. They did 2,000 years ago, but they mm-hmm. no longer do.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 for your questions about astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Glenn writes in to voxpop@wamc.org and says, my daughter is starting her undergraduate degree and is planning to major in astronomy.
Yay.
What advice do you have for young people embarking on that path? P.S. Bob hosted us at his Overlook Mountain Observatory last summer and helped inspire her. So it's Glenn from Woodstock.
So nice.
I'd say make sure your waitressing skills are good.
No.
No, it's actually tough. I know a number of people who've gotten degrees. And for example, early on, I was offered to teach a class at a community college. I think it was $18,000 they were offering me per course. You're not going to get rich usually being an astronomer. Definitely, you'll learn a lot of computer skills, and those will mm-hmm. always be handy. And if you love it, of course, pursue it. You know, you should always pursue what you love. But be aware also that it's math. It's very math heavy. In fact, when I visit Las Campanas, the observatories of the Carnegie Institution, which I used to do every year with a group, the astronomers there told me that math isn't what they do most of the time. It's what they do all the time. It's all they do is math. So just be aware that it's very math intensive, physics intensive. If you think you're going to actually be looking through telescopes at planets and stuff, forget it. No one's going to ever let you look through a big telescope at a planet.
Maybe not a huge one, but you could definitely look through the smaller ones. I think this is a wonderful idea. As a woman who just went through the program, this is great. I'm very excited.
Yeah, I mean, follow your passion, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. Yeah.
Well, let me chime in and give a little advice. So my advice is, you know, it's not going to be easy, but no degree is easy. But, you know, stick with it. If you love the math and you love the science, you're good to go. And, you know, the biggest thing that helped me through was, you know, friends, especially other women, that we could do homework together, that we could get through those toughest courses together, and then just talk to your faculty members. I mean, that's one of my favorite things to do with the students that I have is just chit chat and get to know them. What are they interested in? What do they think they want to do for a career? Because your faculty are there to help you succeed in life. They're there to teach you, but they're also there to give you advice and, you know, give you different opportunities. And the more that they know you, the more they can help you succeed. So I'm really excited to hear where this goes. So make sure that they write back in a couple of years and update us on the program.
Maybe she'll solve why the spot is red.
That would be great. I got a whole list of things that she can work through and solve if she wants it.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Here on Vox Pop with Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rabson, we go back to the phones to Austin in Glens Falls. Hello, Austin.
Hi. I was wondering, why don't we use the space telescopes like James Webb to point at planets in our own solar system to see closer into them, like the spot on Jupiter?
Yeah, so we actually do. We are limited only to Mars outward, because if we were to point at anything in the inner solar system, we would actually have sunlight hitting those mirrors and instruments, and that would be real bad. It would warm them up and would be not good. But we have looked at all of the planets, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and even a blurry picture of Pluto that hasn't been, you know, fully released yet, but I've seen it. It's very cool. So we do look at them, but it doesn't always give us a ton of new information because we're kind of far away. And even though James Webb is like this amazing infrared giant telescope, traveling to these planets and getting pictures really close is often the best way to do it. So you see more results from the orbiters and the flyby missions than you do with James Webb for our solar system.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Austin. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 to call into Vox Pop with your questions about space, astronomy questions for Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson. Can you tell us what about the Pluto picture is cool, or is it like you're not allowed to?
Oh, no, it's not a secret or anything. It's just one of those that there wasn't a big article written about it, but I recently gave a presentation about, you know, what did James Webb see and learn about our solar system, and I was able to dig out a picture, and it is kind of, to be honest, it looks kind of lame compared to some of the other ones we have seen, because when you get to the distance of Pluto, it starts to look almost like a point source, like a blob, you know, compared
to... It's really, really far away.
It is, and it's also really, really small. So even with James Webb, it's hard to see, and, you know, you can see Pluto, and you can kind of see Charon, but it's not, like, highly detailed. It's not like we can zoom in and see, you know, the craters on the surface like we could on the moon or something like that. It's not as good as you would imagine. We have much better pictures from New Horizons, which flew by back in 2015 and was, you know, a few tens of miles above the surface, giving us up close pictures of the hills and the ices and all of that. So, yeah, there's cool images coming out, and they're actively processing all the solar system pictures right now.
What are some of the other things that they've learned from the photos that you included in your recent presentation?
They have some pictures, speaking of Jupiter. They have some nice pictures of the spot, which doesn't look red at infrared wavelengths. You know, you can kind of pick and choose what colors you want to use for different things, but it actually looks a bit white, you know, kind of a mixture of infrared colors, because you're seeing upper haze in the atmosphere, you're not looking at kind of what we would normally consider the surface of Jupiter, because infrared versus optical actually shows you different parts. So we've learned a bit about the clouds on Jupiter, and we've been able to see some of the moons around Uranus and Neptune pretty well, and just kind of mapping out the ring structure and where the moons sit within the ring structure in more detail than we can with, say, Hubble or other small telescopes. So we've learned quite a bit of basic stuff.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. It is Vox Pop. It is Astronomy on Vox Pop today. I'm in studio with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Your calls will be answered at 800-348-2551, and we'll be back after this break. Welcome back to Vox Pop. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and for Ray Graff this afternoon, it is astronomy. That's our topic. I almost said this morning, even though I just said this afternoon, but time is relative, right? That's mm-hmm. That's what we know. No, just kidding. It's the afternoon. 800-348-2551 to give us a call. 1-800-348-2551. And rounding out the excellent articles that you shared with us, Valerie, mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit about this AI search thing that I barely understand. Go ahead.
Yeah, I barely understand it either, because I am no AI expert. But I do know that, you know, one of the issues we face nowadays is this idea of deepfakes, where somebody, you know, creates an image of a person, usually a celebrity or something like that. And it's hard to tell if the picture is real or if it was generated by AI. And one of the things that people that work in tech have figured out is you can actually use astronomy techniques to answer that question. So if a photo is taken of you, you are going to have little reflections in your eyes, because your eyes are just, you know, a set of optics. And each eye should have basically the same little white spots, little reflections from whatever light is in the room. And to figure out whether it looks identical, you can actually use code that we use to study galaxies and to understand how light is distributed across pixels to see if maybe the center of the galaxy is brighter than the edges or whatever structure you want to look for. And it's this code that was developed by astronomers that's being applied to images of people's eyeballs, essentially. And it does a really good job of figuring out if the picture is actually real or if it's one of these deepfake images. So it's for all the people that call in and say, you know, why do we spend so much on astronomy? This is one of the cool ways that an astronomy technique can be used to help us out in the real world. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. I never would have thought to apply, you know, galaxy dynamics and studying the light the galaxies emit to AI images.
And what about you, Bob? Would you have thought of applying what she just said to AI images?
Well, there's so much fakery that you see on the web that of celestial objects or even meteorological phenomena. You can hardly go on the web and not have someone say, look at this image I posted of a halo around the sun at sunrise. Or just the other day, I saw a rainbow surrounding the sunrise, supposedly. And the comments from people were, oh, it's beautiful. Oh, that's so beautiful. And there was a time when I'd write it and say, no, rainbows cannot surround the sunrise or the sunset. They can't be, the sunrise can't be in the center of a rainbow above it, because rainbows are always opposite the sun, always. Mm-hmm. And so this is automatically a fake. Don't people know the basics of rainbows and halos and basic, and the answer is no. People right. don't know the basics, like that a halo around the moon or the sun is always 22 degrees. Well, you don't have to know that, but you should at least know that if you make a hold your hand out at arm's length and stretch out your thumb and your pinky as far as they'll go, and put one of those tips, let's say the thumb tip, on the sun, the pinky tip will show you the halo. In other words, that's the radius, and it works for everybody, because if you've got a bigger hand, you'll usually have a longer arm that goes with it. And so stretched out hands really do measure out 22 degrees for virtually everybody. Hmm. And so you can always mark off a halo of the sun or the moon easily in the sky. But somehow, A, people don't know this. B, no matter what nonsense you see on the web, most people seem to just go by the colors and say, oh, that's gorgeous, that's pretty. And so you sort of just give up. So unlike Valerie, who has more patience or tenacity or intelligence or something that makes her stick with it, I just sort of shrug my shoulders and think of Facebook and the pictures as sort of being a fantasy land,
fiction,
by and large.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to say that's one of the hardest things. You know, when you search an object, it's so hard to know if the pictures that come up are just a sketch, an artist's interpretation, or a real photograph. And that's something we battle in, like, introductory astronomy classes for projects. You know, students will show me something and I'm like, is that real? And it's not their fault. It's hard to know. And even sometimes, like, a few times I've been like, wait, was that the real picture that James Webb put out, or is that a cartoon?
Because right.
it's really hard to tell for some of the non-obvious things. So it's a challenge to be able to tell the difference.
And sometimes the non-reality has an interesting basis. For example, in 1610, when Galileo first looked at the planet Saturn, he sketched it as a ball that had two handles on it, mm-hmm. like a teapot.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons he probably saw it as a ball with attached handles is because on Earth there is no example on any level of reality of a ball surrounded by unattached rings.
Yeah. Right,
right.
We just don't
know?
See this anywhere, not in the microscopic world, not that they had microscopes then, but on no level do we see this. So when something is brand new in your experience, as it was to Galileo, it's not that you make that leap. Oh, yeah, there's a ball with rings around it. That's the planet Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
All they knew back then is that it was the slowest moving of all the so-called gods, because that's what they thought the planets were, moving across the sky, slowest moving. Why is it slow? And then they came to the conclusion that maybe we'd come to today, which is, oh, it must be heavy and sad and sluggish and not feeling great. And so we even have the word, to this day, we have the word Saturnine. Hmm. Not that we use it commonly, but it means somebody who's sluggish and heavy and slow and sad. And that's what they did with these objects. Mercury is mercurial. He's changeable because Mercury moves so fast,
yep.
et cetera. So sometimes you get to these unrealities because of a basis that actually tells you something about their time and their era.
Yeah.
1-800-348-2551. Back to the phones and to Steve in Albany. Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
There
was a news report about the NASA closing down two of the orbiting observatories. I think Hubble was one, and I can't remember the name of the other one for financial reasons. And I just wondered what you thought of that decision and the effect of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a constant struggle, right? These telescopes have been up there for a long time, and they are expensive to keep going. But, you know, my opinion is that if the telescope's in space and it's still working, there's no point in deorbiting it or getting rid of it quite yet. It's well worth it to keep Hubble going as long as it can. And I think it was Chandra, the X-ray observatory, that has this fate as well.
Yes.
And yeah, there's just a lot of, you know, we want to move on and spend the money on the next best thing because we're going to have newer technology and better things, but as long as it's producing good science, I personally think we should keep it. But we do have to find this balance of what is the best way to spend the few dollars that we get on astronomy. So, I mean, I'm always for keeping things going, but we'll have to see how it goes.
The major ongoing debate is usually manned missions. Excuse me for using the misogynistic term "manned missions," but that's the term that's come down. I wish, what would be a good gender-neutral way of saying manned missions? Never mind. I'll give up on that. But in other words, sending probes that don't involve a human being on board can give us. We could do 10 of those for every manned mission. So when we talk about going to Mars, well, sure, we have this urge to explore the neighborhood in person. Yeah, granted that. But we could do 10 times more if we don't subject a person to the risks, don't have to supply them with oxygen and food and bring them back. And that really remains the biggest financial ongoing debate is unmanned probes. I mean, when you think of all that's been done by the Voyager and the Galileo and the Cassini, you can't even name all of them, missions. And Valerie just mentioned New Horizons that went past Pluto, and compare them to, well, how can you compare them to the Apollo missions? I mean, that's so much, so romantic and so nice to have had a couple of us as representatives of our species step foot on another celestial body. So I'm not answering that question. I'm just saying that's the big ongoing debate financially.
But do you think that Hubble and Chandra are still producing important information?
Yes.
Yes.
100%. I know personally a lot of wonderful scientists that are doing great work every day with Chandra and Hubble. So they genuinely are. You might not see it in the news as much because James Webb has kind of taken over. But in the science world, 100%.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Steve. Have a great day. 800-348-2551. We will continue with Sharon in Lansingburg. Hello, Sharon.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. What's your question?
Very good. I've wanted to ask for a long time, throughout human history, when we've ventured to other lands, we have often unknowingly brought pathogens and processes with us that we've introduced things to the new lands that were very harmful to the native inhabitants and environment. And I've wondered for ages, is there a concern in the scientific community for the potential pathogens or damage that we might be doing in space when we leave materials and objects on other planets and asteroids and so forth. I realize that space is inhospitable to life as we commonly know it, but, you know, we learn every year on Earth that there's forms of life that we never dreamed of. So not to mention what we might be bringing back to Earth, you know, space viruses, whatever. I mean, is there any concern in the scientific community for this kind of contamination?
Yeah, there's great concern, and we try to make everything sterile, and we don't always succeed. For example, Apollo 12, when it landed in the Fra Mora area of the moon, just south of the great crater Copernicus, the astronauts were able to hop on over to the Surveyor spacecraft that had been left behind 2.5 years earlier. They did a really nice, precise landing where they could go right over to the old Surveyor craft, snip out some material. It was actually some foam from one of the instruments, bring it back to Earth. And you know what they found? A living Streptococcus mm-hmm. pathogen.
Of course, yep. Strep
in other
will
words,
survive.
It,
of course.
Of course.
It was supposed to be sterile, but this thing had the strep bacterium had survived for 2.5 years in the airlessness of the moon, in the incredible temperatures. You're talking about over 200 degrees by day, closer to 200 below zero at night. Survived for over 2 years on the moon and was still alive. It was still living. And so if you've ever wondered why it's so hard to get rid of a strep throat, just think about Apollo 12, and they saw it firsthand.
Mm-hmm. It's not terribly comforting, is it?
Yeah, so we want to avoid that in the future. So we try to avoid that.
Yeah. But
anything to add, Valerie?
No, Bob said it exactly. We try and sterilize everything, and we also try and destroy spacecrafts instead nowadays. So if we can, we'll send it into the sun or something rather than just like leaving it behind in space so that we don't accidentally contaminate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. 800-348-2551, and we'll go to Dave in Colony. Hello, Dave.
Hi. This is not so much a question as an observation that you might have some input on. A few months ago, I do some amateur astronomy, and a few months ago, I bought a small smart telescope called the C-Star, which relies heavily on AI for its image creation and so on. And it occurred to me and a number of other people, are we really looking at what we think we're looking at, or are we looking at a picture that the telescope figured out that you're trying to see and just downloads for you a nice image from stock pictures? And I got my answer, at least I think I got my answer partly, when I was, I think, shooting an image of course, the Orion Nebula, because it's so photogenic. And along, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes into the stack that I was taking, an airplane flew over. And, oh, look, there it is in the image. So
nice.
I think that kind of answered for me the question of whether it just draws from stock footage or not.
Yeah. Now,
I just thought I'd throw that out to you.
No, it's real. There's no hanky-panky going on there. The real debate that we're having, at least the old-timer astronomers, which unfortunately I have to put myself in that category, is that, for example, in this recent eclipse tour that I led in Texas, we had over 70 people, and three of them had smart telescopes like your own. And some of us were wondering, as you well know, I'm talking to the caller, of course, as you well know, the image occurs on your smartphone or on your screen and is beautiful because you're seeing galaxy detail or the Orion Nebula. You mentioned colorful detail, even from the middle of a city, that you couldn't possibly see with your eye using a much larger telescope. So it's the technology is beautiful. But here's the big but. When they say you'll see the Orion Nebula in just 5 or 10 minutes, and what you're seeing is an image on a screen with those horizontal lines through it made up of pixels, there is a difference between the actual photons that would have traveled through space for 1,500 years from the Orion Nebula into your eyes, into your retina, into your being, incorporated into your being and then translated into your brain as an actual image versus the image on the screen. Mm-hmm. So the only question, I know maybe I'm getting philosophical here, is that the same kind of observing when the final product is a picture on a screen rather than an image you're seeing that's going into your eye, retina, and brain directly through a telescope? That would be my only issue, but it's certainly not whether anyone's faking it and putting up fake M45 images for you to look at.
Yeah, I think these telescopes just, they kind of give you the best view possible, right? It's sorting out the noise. It uses AI to toss out the lousy pictures where the wind picked up something like that. But you're getting the best view possible through these kind of telescopes.
Thank you for your call, Dave.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, I didn't finish talking. I was just going to say I still prefer to pull my 10-inch Dob out and look at the live photons that were sent out to me hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Oh, there you go. Bless your two-chambered heart. Actually, right. The caller probably has a four-chambered heart. So
thank you to everybody who called in today. We are out of time. Thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson, as always, for being here. Great to see you guys.
Thank you.
Learn a lot. Thanks again for joining us today. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Andrea Cunliffe. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., the gardeners are back to dig into your questions. See you then.